Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
This area is up and coming, is a phrase used increasingly in Bristol. Traditionally, poorer and working class areas of the city like Euston, St George, Bedminster are changing, and families who have lived in these neighbourhoods for generations face unaffordable housing, snobbery, homelessness, racism and removal from the communities they love. With me right now for this episode of Bristol for the Record to discuss this very matter and of Bristol's very proud working class history is local lad Henry Palmer, who is the author of the book Voices of Bristol, Gentrification and Us. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Marcus.
So before we get into this, can we define some key terms, please?
Absolutely.
What does working class mean?
Working class can mean lots of things. I think for me, it would mean somebody from today, it would mean somebody from a lower socioeconomic background. Simply put, that's the way that I'd sum it up.
And it's not just white people, is it? It's all people from different shades, isn't it, that can be working class, right?
Yeah. One of the helpful ways to think about class and ethnicity and lots of these issues, sort of causes, is through an intersectional lens, actually. So when we talk about lower socioeconomic people, we know that there's disproportionately more people from non-white British backgrounds to be encompassed in that group. Then there's questions around sexual orientation and gender identity and so forth. And so intersectionality, taking all of them on and acknowledging all of them at the same time, I think is quite a useful approach moving forward, yeah.
Do you think the term working class is actually useful and accurate? Or do you think we should be using other terms like socioeconomic? How do you see it?
I can understand why you ask that. I think a lot of people can be alienated when they hear about working class. Some people sort of say in sort of Tony Blair-esque type way, there is no such thing as working class now. We're all middle class. I think he said something along those lines 20, 25 years ago. I think for some people, working class is synonymous with people from a lower socioeconomic background. For some people, people who are physically working, so they have some sort of, you know, a working job. But then by that definition, somebody like our old Prime Minister Johnson would be considered a working class where he had a job. So it's really subjective. And so for me, the most helpful definition is the one which refers to somebody generally from a lower socioeconomic background, which just means, you know, if you have less financial income, less money, and that kind of thing, yeah.
Is it a culture as well?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a working class culture in terms of... One of the helpful ways that I think about class is a way in which some sociologists think about class, which is according to three areas of capital, if you like, or of thinking about life for people, is the financial capital, how much money somebody has. You know, how much money did their household, did they grow up with, and how much do they have now? Cultural capital, like you just said then, which is what do they consume? What sort of culture are they interested in? You know, long story short, are they more likely to go to the Bath Royale on the weekend or to stay in and watch X Factor or whatever is on TV? That's long story short, right? And that's just a simplification there to illustrate it there. And then... their social capital, which is the type of individuals, type of groups that somebody finds themselves in. So again, for it to simply illustrate, is one's friendship group full of solicitors and accountants and CEOs of large conglomerates, or are their friends from, say, more ordinary professions, occupations, quote unquote? Again, that's a simplification.
And then let's get to gentrification.
Oh, yeah, please.
What's that all about? And this is a topic that you've written about and thought about and researched about, particularly in Bristol. What is gentrification?
So gentrification, simply put, is the influx or the migration, the movement of a higher socioeconomic group into what is traditionally a lower socioeconomic area. Like you said earlier, I grew up in the local area here in Easton. And when we were living in the local area, when we moved in around 1998, the European Commission classed the local area to be one of the most deprived wards in the whole of the southwest of England. And that was certainly true to my experience in the decade that followed. Violence and fear and deprivation in general terms. And something quite interesting for me is when I came back from uni in 2016 from having worked as an Uber driver, I was working as an Uber driver, and I could tell if somebody was new to Bristol or not in my passenger seat, depending on how they responded when I was from Easton. If they were, you know, age-old Bristolians, they would say, "Oh my gosh, would you mind showing us some of your old wounds?" No, I'm joking, but you know, you get the idea. Whereas if they were new to Bristol, they say, "Where are you from?" I say, "Easton." They go, "Oh, nice." So, yeah. So Easton is just one example of an inner city, traditionally lower socioeconomic area, which is slowly becoming gentrified.
What's wrong with gentrification? Surely change is inevitable, right?
So this is actually one of the kind of excuses or justifications that a lot of people generally respond when you speak about gentrification. When I was researching for the book, is this acceptance, this concession that, oh, well, of course areas change. It's just part of a natural evolution. But I think that's really defeatist. And that's because of the negatives that inherently come with gentrification and always have done. So we're talking about things like homelessness. We're talking about unaffordable housing. We're talking about people feeling culturally alienated. I don't culturally feel like I belong here anymore. To be completely frank with you, I didn't know what an avocado was, and I still don't really until a few years ago, right? That is a cultural distinction there. But imagine that en masse applied to lots of different things across the board, types of sports, types of, I don't know, shows and other consumables. So that's what I'd say is don't take a fatalistic kind of defeatist negative view on gentrification. Accept it's a thing, acknowledge, and then work towards doing things about it.
What else is bad about gentrification? In the introduction, I put snobbery, I put racism as well, and then the removal from the communities that people love and that they've grown up in. Can you discuss that more?
So the cultural alienation, if you like, or cultural displacement, as academics refer to it, is quite difficult to quantify. How do you quantify people basically feeling that they don't belong in an area anymore and moving out as a result? There are obviously ways you can do that with surveys and things like that. And another way to gauge it, I suppose, is just through common sense, conversation, discourse. In my book, I spoke to one guy, I think he lived on, I think it was Perry Road or something like that. And he was from a African Caribbean British backgrounds, and he said that effectively, me and my family don't feel comfortable in the area anymore. And I think something to note, I'm not saying this is necessarily the case with Easton or St. Paul's, I'm not saying it necessarily is, but traditionally when gentrification was thought about, it was thought about in tandem with whitewashing, right? So people from white British backgrounds generally having more socioeconomic capital, being posher, therefore being able to buy up these poorer places, but then displacing some of the inhabitants who are from non-white British backgrounds before. This isn't necessarily happening in the same way today. I think it is in certain respects. I actually think there's a piece of work to be done there, looking more into that. A little bit of research I did looked at Ashley, the ward of Ashley in St. Paul's a few years ago, and I found that actually the Caribbean, Jamaican, mostly Jamaican, Caribbean, it's Caribbean, but it's mostly Jamaican British diaspora, had halved from 2001 to 2011, from about 16% to 8% in the ward of Ashley. And let's not forget, the home of the Windrush generation, effectively. This is the home of the civil rights movement in the UK with the Bristol bus boycott and so on. And then you have conversations with local Caribbean, Jamaican, British people in St. Paul's and Ashley, and they will say that, you know, the culture is changing. It doesn't feel like it used to. Some people say it's positive. Some people say that because of the financial benefits for themselves. For example, that a guy as part of that same bit of research I spoke to said that he bought his council house in 2007 or something for about £80,000, now worth about a third of a million at least. So financially, some locals are benefiting. But when it comes to the cultural cohesion, that's something which is often forgot about.
And this is also happening in more white working class areas, such as Bedminster and such as St. George, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess when you think about non-white British Bristolian communities, wards, what comes to mind is generally Ashley, St. Paul's, Easton, Lawrence Hill. But like you say, St. George less so, and then Bedminster, really quite white, working class, traditional community. And so the experiences are different. So are the cultural consequences. I remember when I was researching for my book, one local Norwest chap said, well, I won't go to North Street, Southville, which, by the way, in the 2019 or 2018 Quality of Life survey, respondents in that area came out and said that they recognised gentrification in the local community more than any other area road in the whole of Bristol. But anyway, he said, I won't go to North Street, Southville, because they don't sell Thatcher cider. And he wasn't joking. And again, that's another example of a cultural disparity there and disconnect.
Indeed. So, Henry, tell us about your upbringing. You grew up in Whitehall, which is next to Easton. How was it growing up?
Yeah, so Whitehall is technically in the ward of Easton, but then it's like you say, the Easton's also an area, so it's technically next to as well. And
yeah, it's like sandwiched between Easton and St. George, isn't it?
Yeah, Whitehall growing up just under the town over there, it was difficult. You know, it was violent. I got into fights and got beat up and got a brick thrown at my window once, I remember. You know, deprivation is quite a helpful word, really, because it sums up violence, substance abuse, you know, all these other sorts of things. Didn't necessarily all apply to me, but under that broad umbrella of deprivation, yeah, I was definitely there, yeah.
And then when did you notice that things were changing in Whitehall and Eastern area? You mentioned when you came back from university.
Yeah, I think having been politicised at uni, like lots of people are, and then having this sort of vernacular and this vocab and of gentrification and social issues and so on. Yeah, and then just seeing more money in the area, seeing the old cafe up the road on Whitehall Road having become a sort of alcohol bar thing, cocktail spirit bar, hey, you want to get drunk? Woohoo, yeah, sort of place. And then, you know, when my mum and dad met at the Green Bank pub in the early 90s, and the fact that they would speak about the Green Bank pub, right, the Green Bank pub as being a spit and sawdust pub, that, you know, anecdotal sort of stories like that help to illustrate it, because the Green Bank pub's certainly not spit and sawdust now. It's, I don't know, varnish and...
Yeah, yoga classes upstairs.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? You know, because as long as people are conscientious and nice, it's all fine.
All right, so the book Voices of Bristol, Gentrification and Us. What inspired you to write this book? Is it your life story in many ways?
What inspired me to write it was the fact that nobody else was really talking about it and with the same emphasis. I think also I've got a bit of a interest with class because my dad's side are from Clifton. Actually, I don't know any of them because my dad left when I was younger. But I know that they're wealthy people from Clifton, and they're still there now, actually. If you're listening, hello. would you just please return my calls? And then my mum's side is from Kingswood, working class council estate, banana bread sandwiches in the 1980s, Kingswood. So for me, I've always been fascinated with class. I think as a result of that, not knowing my dad's side, imagining there's been some sort of class disparity between my mum, my paternal and maternal side, and that there was probably room for reconciliation there. So it comes under gentrification, obviously, because gentrification, gentry, gentleman, the old French, gentil, literally meaning high-born or noble. Do people moving into a traditionally working-class area low-key or subliminally think of themselves as higher-born or as more noble, as better than lower socioeconomic people? That's the insidious consequences of class disparity and a class-based society.
From your research and writing the book, etc., can you name some of the key moments in Bristol's working class history?
So in terms of movements, there's a few in the past and recent that stick out for me. And a working class movement for me is one that progresses the cause of the working class in some way. One of these would be the Queen Square riots of the early 1830s. If you don't know, I think it was 1831, about 500, 600 men protesting around Queen Square in central Bristol because they weren't happy with how far the right to vote had been extended. And the riots went on for days. And in the end, they were chopped down by sword and soldiers. And some people lost their lives. Some people were hanged. And others were arrested, despite petitions of over 10,000 being signed.
Yeah, so I'm guessing what people, men more than likely, were able to vote if they had, like, what, land and a certain amount of wealth and connections.
Yeah, exactly.
But not poorer.
Yeah. So, people. Yeah. So by 1830, so only 6,000 people in Bristol of the 104,000 population had the right to vote.
Wow.
And like you said, that was based on how much money and land white men would have owned. So I think one of the reasons I look to that and I admire that is it's completely in line with the working class movement with class equality and extending the right to vote. And that's a really proud Bristol tradition that at least the aspiration for pushing for that should be looked to. I think another event for me in history I first came across, actually, or it was reiterated for me when I was researching for my book on gentrification, was the Bristol bus boycott in 1963. So if you don't know, the Bristol Omnibus Company effectively said, no, we're only going to employ Bristolians from white British backgrounds. And this wasn't long after the Windrush generation, right? So a huge influx from the Caribbean, from India. The big concern of Bristol Omnibus and other white Bristolians and the system effectively being, well, if we employ non-white people, then there's going to be no jobs for everybody else. So what was amazing about the Bristol bus boycott, of course, was it was black people, white people, people from all different types of backgrounds coming together and basically demanding for the right of people from non-white British backgrounds to be employed. And I think it was something like, it was late August, I can't remember the exact day, I think it was August 28th or something, and it was the same day that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech, that the Bristol Omnibus Company lifted their ban, and non-white British, Bristolian and Bristolian drivers were able to be employed. And that's such a beautiful, I think, moment in Bristolian history, working class history.
It should really be part of the school curriculum nationally, I believe.
Yeah.
Because, you know, civil rights is always with an American focus in education, but it's happened right here on our doorsteps. Racism exists here too.
Yeah. Why do we... Yeah, why? I don't know why we always go to...
Yeah, I think it's a denial, personally.
I mean, obviously Rosa Parks, an amazing individual. Yeah. Martin Luther King, amazing. Malcolm X, amazing. But why do we always look over the Atlantic and not look literally just up the road? But yeah, denial, but perhaps it's too close to home.
Do you have any other key moments or movements for us?
I think the recent Kill the Bill protests, outside of them being violent, need to be looked at with admiration in Bristol.
Oh, controversial.
Yeah, so I say that in respect of peaceful protest, firstly, needs to be at the forefront of any movement, I think. Violence is never justified.
But would you say that's a working class movement, or is that just like a bunch of, I don't know, middle class hippies, students having a go at the police? They're not from Knowle, they're not from Bedminster or St George, are they? They're more likely to be from, I don't know, Redland or Froome.
Well, see, I've heard this before, and the truth is, I really don't know what the background of these protesters are. I've heard this argument before. I mean, has anyone else carried out a sample survey of the Kill the Bill protesters? Are the Kill the Bill what became riots, unfortunately, in the end, but protests before that, in the tradition, a historical Bristolian tradition of Bristolians coming together for what's right and what they believe in together? Yeah, and I think recognising why they did that is important.
But do you think people from working class communities actually care about this? Because they're having to put food on the table and pay the bills. Was Kill the Bill something that they cared about, or was this a different group of people?
See, this is what I wonder about as well. Is you hear about riots like the Queen Square riot, right, of 1831 that we spoke about earlier, and other Chartist movement riots and any other sort of riot or protest where it's been historically in Bristol or across the country, where it's been people actually protesting for the right to vote because they're desperate to vote. Fast forward to today, you have voting numbers of people voting in the population of between 40% and 60%, despite 100% of adults being able to vote.
Okay, so we've talked about key moments in Bristol's working class history. Are there any key people, key heroes that you would like to highlight?
I could say loads and loads, but actually, it's you, Mark. I'm joking. Okay, so... It's Lawrence Hu, actually.
Tell us more about Lawrence Hu.
So Lawrence Hu is a Bristol born and bred boy. I met him whilst researching for my book originally, actually, on gentrification. But he's sort of St. Paul's ways, a bit of Eastern. And the reason I admire Lawrence is he speaks about social issues in a real way and in a way that isn't diluted. And with all of his faults on show, I think. And I think that's really important for people that you admire and look up to, is for their faults to be on show. Beware the infallible, right? Beware the omniscient, because nobody's infallible and nobody's omniscient. Lawrence, yeah, hat goes off to you, man. Keep doing what you're doing. He's a good working class roots Bristolian guy who's doing amazing, great things. And I'm happy to know him.
Any others in Bristol? Bristol working class heroes, in your opinion?
Carrie Bells, a councillor in Hartcliffe, another legend, doing amazing things, is proper Bristolian girl, quite frankly, you know what I mean? That is proper representation that we need more of.
Yeah, for sure. But then also like South Bristol, some of the most deprived areas in the country, the lowest amount of young people going on to university. Quite a lot of people focus on the more inner city backgrounds, but actually when you go deep south, like yeah. Withywood and Hartcliffe.
Yeah.
That is people really struggling there.
Yeah, yeah, completely. I went to school in Whitchurch, I know, as you know, in St. Bernadette's, and it's where I picked up the accent, actually. And yeah, it's a complete different kettle of fish. Yeah, white working class communities have their own priorities and issues. Mm.
And still very much so, because the gentrification hasn't reached out there yet, because it's probably a bit too far or not well connected.
Yeah.
But maybe that's where you're still getting a working class area in Bristol, still
yeah.
very much so. And you've got these large families as well that are living on the same street, in the same neighbourhoods, have lived there for generations as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there is, you know, it's not perfect in a lot of those communities, and they'd say the same. But I think if there is one thing that's stronger in those communities, in some of them, Knowle West, certain places in Bemmy, Hartcliffe, so on, is there is a feeling of community, of knowing one's neighbour. I think Bemmy BS3 Southville is a sign of things potentially to come in around Broadwalk now. Knowle, huge development's going to be going up there. I honestly don't know what sort of clashes and issues are going to result from South Bristol gentrification, because... Yeah.
because I guess they always sort of work and live together, isn't it? Because there were really big factories in Hartcliffe from the tobacco industry, not there anymore.
Yeah.
Would employ several thousand people, and they would all live within like sort of walking distance of the factory.
Yeah.
In a way, that's sort of the romanticized image of working class, isn't it?
Yeah.
All working together in the factory, all living near,
yeah, yeah.
Walking back, going to the pub afterwards, playing football on the weekend.
Yeah.
In a way, that was, you know, the classic working class environment, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And this is the important thing, right? And it sort of is important not to glorify what coming from a working class background always means. It's not always that the community coming together and loving each other and so on. It's free school meals. It's not being able to pay for university. It's no holidays. It's a stressed out single parent who doesn't have time for emotional investment in their children, and also, and, you know, local crime and violence, all sorts of things.
Now, coming towards the end of the interview, how do you see the future of Bristol's working class? Do they have a future in the city, or is it going to be pushed out to the outskirts and beyond?
Well, Bristolians have never folded historically. There's never been a time when there was not somewhere in Bristol some sort of calls being fought for or protest or, you know, contentious sort of anti-establishment view being made. And so I like to think that Bristol sort of outlook will always stay alive. But I think people need to seriously become political animals, take an interest in politics, join a union, vote for the right causes, join the right causes, the right policies, because that's ultimately where the biggest impact is done.
Henry, I've got lots of friends who have grown up in Bristol, have young families, can't afford to remain in the city, and they've had to move to South Wales, to Yate, to Gloucester. You know, they've grown up here, their parents and their grandparents were here. Bristol's changing a lot, mate.
Yeah, yeah. And
do you see it just going to continue that way, or do you see there's going to be a change in direction?
I think, at the end of my book, you know, I forward lots of suggestions and potential solutions, suggested solutions to gentrification, if you're speaking about gentrification. And that is building real council housing, social housing, rent caps. It's policies and causes like that which are going to really slow down the negative impacts of gentrification, create more harmonious communities. So I think, you know, the jury's out on this thing. It's, if people want to fight for something, then they will. If they love Bristol and they want to keep Bristol the way it is, or at least they want it to be, to continue to be loved and to love it, then they'll fight for it.
And what does the future hold for you, Henry?
I'm interested in politics. I'm interested in bringing communities together, interested in writing. So for me, just, I think, what is it? What's that saying? Write, do in Bristol fashion, or whatever. Anyway, you're listening, you get it.
Is it ship shape?
Ship shape in Bristol fashion. Yeah, we're trying to remain, looking to remain ship shape in Bristol fashion, and just carrying on trying to do good work where I can.
Henry Palmer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcus.